Good evening. 30 years since the wall fell, veterans and suicide, and Adam Schiff, no friend to progressives. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Saturday, November 9th, 2019. And Germans used this weekend to celebrate 30 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall, while Chancellor Angela Merkel said she wanted to ensure that no walls separate people ever again. The Cold War, global power struggle between the United States and Soviet Union, came crashing down on November 9, 1989. The momentous historical event was made possible only by the consent of the World War II victors, the Western Allies, the U.S., U.K., and France, and the Communist Soviet Union. Surrounded by nearly 100-mile-long guarded border of concrete and barbed wire, citizens in Berlin's western sector lived in an island in the middle of the Communist German Democratic Republic, commonly known as East Germany. That all changed in an instant on November 9th, 1989, when a new East German travel policy was announced at a press conference live on state TV. The law announced that, effective immediately, all East German citizens were free to travel to the West. Thousands of people ran straight to the guarded border crossings in the heart of Berlin, which would be opened just hours later. Concessions made by Mikhail Gorbachev, a Soviet reformer who came to power in 1985, were key to the agreement. Gorbachev's policy of glasnost, openness, and perestroika reform were a clear break from Soviet doctrine that aimed to keep the Soviet Union and its Eastern European allies from diverging from Kremlin policy. In 1991, the Soviet Union itself fell, and the new nation of Russia that replaced the communist state entered a period of chaos and uncertainty, eventually giving rise to a government generally seen as an oligarchy, a nation ruled by rich elites. Vladimir Putin, a former communist, was elected to the presidency of Russia, a country rich in resources and promise, but often hamstrung by its long and tortured history. Mikhail Gorbachev was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1991. The United States and Russia worked out a series of agreements in the 1990s to halt their dangerous nuclear weapons competition, but today some of these historic treaties are under attack by the Trump administration, raising fears of a new Cold War. And in national news, tests of lung samples taken from 29 patients with vaping-related injuries suggest all contain vitamin E acetate. U.S. officials described the findings on Friday as a breakthrough in the investigation of the nationwide outbreak that has topped 2,000 cases with 39 deaths. The discovery of vitamin E acetate in lung samples offers the first direct evidence of a link with the substance and vaping-related lung injuries. The substance has also been identified in tests by U.S. and state officials of product samples collected from patients with the vaping injury. But the CDC cautions that more studies need to be done to definitively declare it a cause. Vitamin E acetate is believed to be used as a cutting agent in illicit vaping products containing THC, the component of marijuana that gets people high. Researchers added that not every vaping pen tested contained the additive. And President Donald Trump plans to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn a ruling requiring his accounting firm to turn over 8 years of his tax returns to New York prosecutors, setting the stage for a possible decision before the 2020 election. Lawyers for Trump and Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance said on Friday that the president intends to ask the Supreme Court by November 14th to review Monday's ruling on the tax returns by the Federal Appeals Court in Manhattan. Monday's ruling by the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals authorized Vance's office to enforce a subpoena to obtain Trump's tax returns from the accounting firm Mazars LLP. And Facebook Incorporated is taking down any content that claims to name the anonymous whistleblower who ignited an impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump. That's what the social network said on Friday. The company's statement follows right-wing Breitbart News' publication of an article that said it identified the whistleblower. The alleged whistleblower, who WBAI will not identify, but to say is a young male who works for the CIA as an analyst. Facebook said in a statement, any mention of the potential whistleblower's name violates our coordinating harm policy, which prohibits content outing of witnesses, informants, or other activists. And in New York City, local children joined Congresswoman Yvette D. Clark in walking to support migrant children at the border. Clark said she put together Brooklyn's Children's Support Children's Walk after receiving letters from local youth concerned about events at the southern border. In a release, Clark's office said today's walk provided local children and community members who are disgusted with what's happening at the southern border an opportunity to come together in solidarity against the Trump administration's racist and xenophobic policies. Here's what the kids had to say.
Good afternoon, my ladies, gentlemen, and children. I am honored to speak up for the children who do not have a voice.
Very nice.
When people need help, they go to someone who is wealthier or more powerful. Immigrant families are seeking our help. Think about this. If you have resources to help, would that make the world better if you help or turn your back? Yes. Think about it. Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
My name is Chanel Grouder from Black Girls Can Club at McAdoo. I am heartbroken that some leaders are being malicious and taking children away from their families. I want to use my voice to change the world. I want to say, let us stand up for immigrant children.
Yeah. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jessica Torellis, and I'm from McAdoo School of Science and Technology.
All right.
I am...
Downcast
that the children in Mexico are in this detention. I am here to show empathy to them.
That's right. Thank you.
Meanwhile, another group of immigrants is facing a challenge imposed by Trump. Aspirations of the Dreamers, undocumented immigrant youth who've spent their whole lives in the United States, will be in the hands of the Supreme Court on Tuesday. The court has a 5-4 conservative majority, including two justices appointed by Trump. The court is scheduled to hear arguments to decide the legality of Trump's plan to rescind the program and expose the DACA recipients. DACA is the name of the Dreamers that are given to the Dreamers. Once again, to the threat of deportation. The justices will hear the Trump administration's appeals of three lower court rulings in California, New York, and the District of Columbia that found that the president violated a U.S. law called the Administrative Procedure Act in seeking to kill DACA. The DACA recipients received backing from various business groups and companies, including Microsoft Corp and Apple Incorporated, that filed briefs with the Supreme Court opposing Trump's move. And Monday is Veterans Day, once known as Armistice Day. It marks the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month of the year 1918, when World War I, the bloody conflict that introduced the world to total war, finally ended. Millions of soldiers and millions more civilians died in the conflict that paved the way for the even more violent war known as World War II that broke out in 1939. Until recently, little was known about how the ravages of war affect the returning soldier. Recent studies show that combat veterans suffer suicide rates more than 10 times that of similarly aged non-combatants. A senior fellow at the Center for International Policy is Matthew Ho. He's a former U.S. Marine and a veteran of Afghanistan and Iraq wars who has had his own struggles with suicide.
I'm a veteran of the United States Marine Corps. I was in the Marine Corps from 1998 to 2008. I also was with the U.S. State Department, and I was in the Iraq War as a company commander. and also in both Iraq and Afghanistan on State Department teams as a civilian for the U.S. government.
Is this something that's happening more in terms of these wars on terrorism, as they're called, and previous wars, Vietnam, Korea, World War II?
Everything we know about previous wars, whether going back the last century, going back through the American Civil War, going back into historical accounts, whether it be Native Americans, whether it be Greeks and Romans, we know that war has always brought about severe psychiatric and psychological and moral consequences for those who participate in it. The high rates of suicide that we're seeing now, one, we know about them because the question is being asked and data is being collected. But even so, it's only been in the last decade, really, that the Veterans Administration has been asking for the data from the states and from the Center for Disease Control to really know how many veterans are killing themselves. It's only been since 1980 that the Pentagon actually kept tabs on how many soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen were killing themselves. So the data we have only really goes back a few decades. But what we know is that those veterans of wars have higher rates of suicide than veterans who haven't been to war, and certainly have much higher rates of suicide than civilians of their own age and sex. Veterans in general have a higher rate of suicide as a general population than civilians do. When adjusted for age and sex, if you're a veteran, you're 1.5 times more likely to die by suicide than a civilian. When you start looking at those who've been to war, though, that gets very elevated. For Iraq and Afghan veterans, depending upon their age and depending upon if they're male or female, when compared to others of their age and sex, their rates of suicide are 4 to 10 times higher than civilians. And we've seen in some studies and some reports that for, say, infantry units, the guys that go out and see the most combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, they have rates of suicide 14 times higher than other young men of their own age who didn't serve. World War II veterans, so men who are in their 80s and 90s, have rates of suicide 4 times higher than their peers who didn't serve. This was something that previous eras of warriors suffered through whenever they returned home from war.
Is this because war is hell? I mean, war, we all know war is hell. People go there and they see horrific things and it impacts them forever. Or is there something else at work?
That's exactly it, Paul. I mean, that is exactly it. There's a number of things that go into why a person chooses to take their life via suicide. And for veterans, that's no different. But what makes a difference between a veteran and a veteran who's been to combat, and why do we see those elevated rates of suicide in combat, is specifically because war is hell, as you said. There's no getting around that. The term that is being used now is called moral injury, and it often has to do with what you have seen, what have you been exposed to, but it's also what you have done. In 2015, the University of Utah has a Center for National Veterans Studies, and they did a meta-analysis of the literature out there, the research literature out there on the link between combat and suicide. And it was very clear out of 22 studies, 21 of those studies showed a very clear connection, a very real connection between suicide and combat. And very often the reasons for that were things had to do with feelings of shame, regret, guilt. You go to war and you do something that violates your own moral code. You transgress against the person that you thought you were. And that never leaves you. This moral injury, something that I've been afflicted with, something that I've dealt with, that was the root of my suicidality, I can't overstate what that does to you. It basically rips out the foundations of your life because you are not the person you expected yourself to be. And so it's a very real, serious problem. It's something that has affected all generations of warriors. And, you know, it certainly is compounded now in the United States by circumstances of these wars. Say with the Iraq War, you went and you did terrible things. You took part in terrible things. And that war was all based on lies. And then you come home, and you told you're a hero, you go to a baseball game, you're asked to stand up so 50,000 people can applaud you. So that compounds it. And then as well, too, you're dealing with issues of post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, substance abuse, depressive disorders, and that compounds this moral injury. And so that's why we see these very, very high rates of suicide in Iraq and Afghan war veterans, in veterans of the Vietnam and Korean wars, the World War II veterans. Information we have on the Civil War was that after the Civil War, hundreds of thousands of veterans from both sides of the conflict died from suicide, from alcoholism, from morphine overdoses, because of what they had taken part in during the war.
What do we do about this? What do we do about it? What do you think people should do?
I mean,
on this Veterans Day.
There's a lot that can be done about it. Veterans who are in veterans health care have a better chance of surviving than veterans who are not. That's very clear. Tough love. If you know somebody who is going through this, tough love is not what they need. What they need is compassion and empathy and to begin to get professional care. However, that all said, the only thing that can be done to keep veterans from killing themselves, to keep combat and war veterans from killing themselves, is simply not to go to war. This is the results of war. These are the consequences. What we bring to other people with our wars overseas, that comes home. And that destroys the veterans, it destroys their families and friends, and it destroys their communities. And that's a very real consequence of war that there is no escaping from.
Matthew Ho is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a U.S. Marine veteran. On Monday, President Trump will be in New York to attend the city's annual Veterans Day parade. It's the first presidential visit to New York City for Veterans Day. Usually, presidents attend ceremonies at Arlington, Virginia, the premier national cemetery for veterans. Trump has been criticized for dissing veterans such as John McCain, but he often claims he's done more for the military than any other president. The current U.S. military budget is $693 billion, as much as the next several countries combined. And in more impeachment news, the top Republican on the House Intelligence Committee has formally requested that the panel's chairman, Democratic Representative Adam Schiff of California, testify in a closed-door setting as part of the impeachment inquiry against President Trump. A letter written by committee ranking member Devin Nunes, also of California, demanded that Schiff appear for a deposition in private before lawmakers. Nunes's letters states that in August 2019, Schiff and his staff, quote, met with or talked to the whistleblower who raised an issue with President Trump's phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky. Schiff maintains that he has not personally spoken with the anonymous whistleblower. Schiff announced Wednesday that his committee would hold the first open hearings of the impeachment inquiry next week, featuring current and former officials with knowledge of the Ukraine controversy. While many Democrats and others opposed to Trump welcome the impeachment inquiry, some have pointed out that Schiff, a former blue dog or centrist Democrat, is in fact no progressive. Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. He has an article on Schiff in the Progressive magazine.
Adam Schiff may be doing a decent job as heading the impeachment inquiry, but this a Republican line that he's some kind of a left-winger is based on a fantasy. Adam Schiff is actually one of the more conservative Democrats in Congress. He is a strong supporter of the Iraq war, of the Israeli occupation, and on areas ranging from civil liberties to human rights, international law, the United Nations. He has often sided with Republicans against the majority of his fellow Democrats. And so I think we should be careful that while the impeachment inquiry should be defended, not to fall into a trap of acting like Adam Schiff is some kind of progressive hero.
Give us some background on what are some of these things that he, what are the positions he's taken that are not progressive, in your opinion?
I'm primarily familiar with his foreign policy position, which is definitely in the hawkish wing, in addition to supporting the Bush and Cheney against the majority of his fellow Democrats on the question of whether the U.S. should invade Iraq. He has been one of the biggest the Kudniks in Congress, that is, supporter of Netanyahu and his policies, defending the settlements, the illegal Israeli outposts in occupied Palestinian territories. He has also supported legislation that would effectively ban campaigns for corporate responsibility and other BDS type activities in opposition to the occupation, raising serious concerns from the American Civil Liberties Union and others. He's attacked the United Nations and various human rights organizations for documenting war crimes and other violations of international humanitarian law by the Israeli government. And ironic for someone who is being attacked for supposed liberal bias in an investigation, he trashed one of the world's leading international jurists, Richard Goldstone, for his and his committee's investigation of Israeli war crimes by both Hamas and Israel. And even though the investigation confirmed what Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and other groups had found, and even though they were also quite critical of Hamas, the fact that they documented Israeli war crimes as well led him to denounce it as irredeemably biased and applauded the Bush administration for rejecting the findings and insisted that the findings be ignored.
Now, one of the big issues, of course, in the impeachment hearings is the Ukraine and the fact that the Trump administration allegedly withheld armaments that had been granted to Ukraine in its war with Russia, itself sort of a dubious position. I mean, the Obama administration had refused to give those arms and didn't want to give those arms. So, in a sense, is a lot of this impeachment hubbub around the Ukraine about giving more weapons to Ukraine to fight Russia? Not a progressive position, I would think.
Schiff has been a big supporter of the United States arming Ukraine, and even those of us who are very critical of Russian maneuvers against Ukraine's sovereignty have raised concerns that more armaments would just lead to more killing, and there needs to be a diplomatic settlement. But I think the issues around the impeachment inquiry are less about whether or not the U.S. should arm Ukraine, but the reasons that Trump initially held up the delivery of these congressionally mandated arms shipments. It wasn't because he was concerned about fueling an arms race or creating a new Cold War or creating more bloodshed or any of the reasonable reasons one might disagree with the arms transfers, but he was using it as leverage, apparently, for investigations on a political opponent. So I think the inquiry on the Trump's role in the Ukraine arms transfers is quite legitimate. But I do think that we should be careful not to therefore reach the conclusion that, oh, sending arms to Ukraine is a good thing.
Right. And so let me just end up with what should we expect from Adam Schiff, and how should we withhold our credulity in some of these things?
Again. Well, he is a professional prosecutor prior to running for Congress, and I do believe we should support Schiff as far as it goes in terms of pursuing the impeachment inquiry. What we shouldn't do is assume that he has a progressive agenda, and we should be cautious that this inquiry is not used as an excuse for renewing a Cold War against Russia.
Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. He has an article on Schiff in The Progressive titled Adam Schiff, No Friend of Progressives. And finally, as the mercury dipped over New York City, NYCHA residents got good news for the coming winter. The federal monitor overseeing the housing authority said Thursday he signed off on a plan to spend $450 million of state money for new elevators and boilers. But activists say the money, although welcome, is way too late. Marnie Halassa and Luis Flores are members of the activist group Fight for NYCHA. They say the three-year timetable for the changes will leave thousands of residents in the cold this winter.
They should have been giving this money much, much earlier. But also the thing is, from my understanding, is that the money for these repairs, it's going to take 3 years. It's supposed to be 3 years. It's not like immediately. So on one hand, I think Cuomo wants like a pat on the back because he's giving NYCHA money, money that's already been owed to them. It's already freezing in New York City now. So the governor and the mayor and city council, everybody has to do much, much more, much quickly.
My name is Luis Flores. I'm a member of Fight for NYCHA. It's great that Cuomo has found and given this $450 million, but the reality is that just on heating alone, NYCHA is estimated to need $3 billion. And by only allocating $450 million, they're basically admitting that NYCHA is going to go without heat this winter. Because like Marnie said, this money isn't going to be doled out until 3 years from now. And that's what we find unacceptable.
And what is the problem that people face inside of NYCHA houses? There's always horror stories. Is this common lack of heat, lack of elevators, other basic things that you would be forced to give if you were a private landlord?
These are routine complaints. I foiled all the data about repairs and the repair and maintenance logs from NYCHA. These are routine complaints. 300,000 complaints or more are generated every year based on lack of heat. That means the entire system basically loses heat at least once during the winter, and possibly multiple units lose heat during any one winter season. That's unacceptable.
And also, we created a proposal to fully fund NYCHA. So there's five proposals basically to tax corporations and also tax the wealthy. Julia Salazar has a proposal to tax millionaires.
He's proposed to create new tax brackets for millionaires. And that would potentially raise from the state level approximately $30 billion for the present value of that tax money it would raise.
So we came up with this proposal to fully fund NYCHA, and what we want to do is just keep public housing public, keep it the way it is. Public housing, really, they're deeply affordable units. There's nothing else like public housing and the affordability of it. We want to maintain and preserve that, and coming up with this people's budget that basically found $390 billion can definitely fully fund NYCHA. One out of 13 New Yorkers live in NYCHA. And also another statistic is that NYCHA is the 10th largest city in America. By implementing the people's budget, that would solve really everything.
Marnie Alassa and Luis Flores are members of the activist group Fight for NYCHA. And that's some of the news for Saturday, November 9th, 2019. The news was engineered by James Irsay from the studios of the local and independent WBAI Evening News. I'm Paul D'Arienzo.
Coming up at 6:30 on WBAI, the Laura Flanders Show.
And please send a check or money order to support WBAI to WBAI 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. Attention, General Manager, make the checks or money orders out to WBAI-Pacifica Radio. All right, WBAI, send your checks or money orders made out to WBAI-Pacifica Radio to WBAI 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. Attention, GM. Thank you. Induction, then destruction. Who wants to die?